This is Whitley Strieber, and this is Dreamland. You've reached the edge of the world.
Well, today on Dreamland, we have a very interesting new look at something very old. A few weeks ago, we looked at the UFO experience in Fatima, and there was another early UFO experience, which we're going to be talking about today, in the 1930s in Italy, that's little known outside of Europe, but it hasn't really taken off much in the United States, and it should, because it's a very, very important event, and it's been brilliantly researched by a remarkable man who you will meet right now. There we go. Here's Roberto Pinotti.
Hi.
Roberto is a very well-established Italian ufologist. Roberto, you'll have to give me your credentials because I can't find them in English.
No, in Italy, I am the only living founder of Centro Ufologico Nazionale, the UFO National Research Center, established in 1967. So it's rather important since it's a 57 year that we keep on researching and doing our best to let UFO reality known in Italy, and not only in Italy, of course. I wrote up to this moment 65 books about different arguments, but most about the UFO problem. And some of them were also published abroad, not only in Italy. But what is important is that we succeeded in, since 1993, in having an international World Congress in San Marino.
I've been dying to go there since 1993. I've been dying to go to that conference since 1993, and when is it going to be in 2024? Has it already happened?
Yeah, in fact, in a few days, on the 1st and on the 2nd of June of this year, we will have the 33rd edition of this Congress. It's rather important because last year we obtained a remarkable effect. we convinced the Parliament of the Republic of San Marino to be involved in the UFO problem. They discussed this topic, voted, and decided that their government has to present the topic to the next, not this year, obviously, but next year, General Assembly of the United Nations. So this is important, really, because I don't know what will be the result, but it's rather important, after all.
Well, yeah, it surely is. And, I've heard so many good things about this conference. And so are you going to do the conference at the UN this year, next year, or is it going to be a separate?
No, this year is impossible because due to the political crisis in the government of the Republic of San Marino, since they have their elections the week immediately after the Congress of this year. Then it will be the next government to have to face this subject. But no problem, because their parliament decided this. So Let's see what will happen.
Well, I hope I get to come to the...
I like the to next... be optimistic.
Yeah, exactly. Well, I don't know, folks, if you heard and saw me sort of moving around. Siri decided to join the conversation all of a sudden.
Yeah.
And I hopefully turned Siri off. Normally that does not happen. But Siri was helping me find Roberto's information which I do not need because I have Roberto right here to tell me everything we need to find out about. Roberto, you started in ufology in Italy a long time ago. What brought you to it in the first place?
Well, it's a long story. I began everything when I was a teenager. And my grandmother was a sort of mentor in this because she was very involved in mysterious things. And so when I was very, very young, 12, 13, I began to be involved in all this. And the first book I did not tell you that my grandmother knew English, of course. And so she began also to learn me something when I was a boy. And one day my father said, okay, but since you are beginning to know something in English, well, come with me. I take you to a library. You choose a book you may be interested in. And so you may try to begin to read it. So this would be useful for your knowledge of English. And I found in this library a book by Maurice Jessup, The Case for the UFO. I still have this book. It was a bantam book, a pocket book, and it was published in 1955. And consider that I was born in 1944. I read this book in the second half of the 50s and began to be interested in the topic. And in this book, there were a lot of addresses of people involved in UFO research. So I began to write them. And nobody asked me, excuse me, how old are you? So I began to exchange material, paper clippings, reports, and so on. And so this is the story. The rest is what happened.
It's a great story, and it's such a familiar one in many ways. The usual glitches here. My listeners are used to them, between just strange electronic glitches and my inefficiency with electronics. All kinds of things happen on this show that don't happen on other shows, I'm sorry to say. In any case, this level of interest is often accompanied or begun by a close encounter, but you didn't mention one, so I don't think that happened to you. I'm assuming it didn't. Is that correct?
Well, yes. In my ufological experience as a researcher, as a writer, and so on, well, I was involved on four different occasions directly in UFO sightings in different parts of the world. But probably the most interesting one was in 1978. When in Italy we had, in that year, about 2,000 sightings. It was an incredible UFO wave. And one day, with other 10 people, we could observe a dozen of different UFOs in the skies between midnight and 3 after a.m. And you understand that 3 hours is a long period of time. We saw their maneuvers. They were also photographed by us. Frankly, it's not too interesting because, you see, to photograph the night sky, you only see a dot of light and nothing else.
Yes.
It may be useful only to us in order to convince us that we are not dreaming. But this event lasted 3 hours. It was very, very incredible. Imagine something like, for instance, the Phoenix Light, for instance, you understand, in America, something like that. So yes. It was very, very suggestive, yes. Then other single sightings is very interesting. But once in Mexico, I was the consultant for the Swiss Italian television, and for the 50th year of the UFO sightings, they organized a TV program. So we went with this team of the Swiss Italian television to the United States and also to Mexico. And we went also to interview a contactee, a Mexican contactee, Carlos Diaz. Well,
oh, yes.
I cannot tell you anything about him, after all. We just interview him. Okay, I saw UFOs. These are my photographs and so on. Okay. But apart from this, after this interview, that night, since in Tepoztlán, the place in which he lived, well, you may understand that there was no movida in it. We asked, I and the director of the TV troupe, what shall we do this night? And they said, well, here there is nothing to do. Let's go to Carlos Diaz's house. So maybe we may drink something with him. We go, we went to towards his house, and we were surprised in seeing a UFO over his house. The most stupid thing that we did is that we began to observe all this for about 3 or 4 minutes. Then a cry in the night, and the director of the TV troupe said, "The cameras!" Because we did not, we had the TV cameras. We did not think that we could really film this. And before we took them out of the car, everything was over. This is curious. Don't ask me anything, but we saw them.
Well, when we come back from the break, which we're going to take right now, we're going to ask Roberto, what did you see? Because it's quite fascinating. All right, we're taking a break. Wait. Roberto, yeah. We're taking a break. So just be silent for a couple of seconds. Okay, uh-huh. I'll come back to you. So this is now the beginning of the break. We're talking to Roberto Pinotti from Italy, his website, robertopinotti.com. We're going to be talking about one of the most remarkable events in the history of UFOs and also one of the first in just a few minutes. But right now, where we were in Mexico, and there was a lot of controversy about the gentleman that you're talking about, Diego, what was his name?
Carlos Diaz.
Carlos Diaz, yeah. And at the time, because some of the UFO pictures he made were rather remarkable, and people were wondering what to think of them. Big red objects sort of hanging in the sky. I've seen some of the pictures, and they're strange. And you saw something over his house, though, which means that there's a level of authenticity.
Yes.
Describe what you saw.
No, it was more or less exactly what he photographed. He called these objects naves de luz, ships of light. And yes. In fact, their form was, they were luminous and orange light, more or less. And the form was a sort of saucer-shaped object, more or less, with a sort of cupola in their upper part, and that's it. Was a single object we saw and nothing else. But frankly, don't ask me why this object was above his house. Frankly, we can't judge him. Frankly, I have my opinion about Carlos Diaz. I'm sure that really he observed real objects, and probably that his photographs are authentic. The problem is that, as many contactees, he also had a story about all this. And as you know, sometimes contactees create a sort of invention, yes, about their experience. They say a lot.
I know that
things,
very well.
Yeah.
It's one of the great painful problems with the whole close encounter experience and the contactee experience. I have struggled with it myself for years because it's so easy to slip into story from fact.
Exactly.
And I agree with you. I'm sure Carlos did that to some extent, because if you're not prepared for it, it's easy to do. Fortunately, in my case, I had my wife, Anne, who was not allowing that to happen. It was not going to happen. And she would pull me back every time I sort of went down that path. And I learned how to be really rigorous about it. And some other contactees have too. But if it comes to unexpected, like it came to him, then, you know, things can happen. And they did. But anyway, the photographs are extraordinary. And the fact that you saw that object, which we're showing now on the screen, is remarkable. Because that was so unusual. I'm just making a note for the video editor here. So unusual that I thought when I first saw images of it that it must be a fake. But no. Okay, so let's go on. Those are a couple of remarkable sightings in your adventure. And we're going to explore a little bit. Why do you think it is? And let's go back to Italy now. We were in Mexico, folks. Now we're going back to Italy. And why is it? Italy has a truly exceptionally large number of UFO events. More, I think, even than certainly more than the UK and Germany, by far more than Germany, more than France, I think.
And maybe it's close.
They're very close, France and Italy.
Well,
why is that?
From an historical point of view, in Italy we had the different UFO waves. The first one was in 1950. The second one was in 1954, and it was at the same time of another important UFO wave in France. It was probably a part of a wider wave in Europe. In any case, it was very important with about 1,000 sightings in 1954. Then another important UFO wave was in 1973. And then the most important, absolutely, was between 1978 and 1979, with more than 2,000 sightings. And in this situation, the Italian government had to face seriously the problem, and they asked the Italian Air Force to be charged in this topic. And so since 1979, the Italian Air Force simply is involved not in investigating, but in collecting UFO data. And in this moment, they have on file about 500 official cases. And this is absolutely interesting because it is an official body of the Italian government, and this is still on.
Now, in Brazil, there were not only a lot of sightings, but also people were literally being hunted down in the forest at times. The story is harrowing. Was anything like that happening? Or perhaps I'm right. Anyway, we're going to take the second break now, and we'll be right back. All right, so before the break, I was asking you whether or not there had been a lot of close encounter events in Italy during these flat UFOs.
Yes, everything began with the 1954 wave with different close encounters of the third kind. And this was repeated also in 1973 and also in 1978 and 79, but also later, because we had other UFO waves in 1985, for instance, and also towards 2000. But what is interesting, there are patterns in all this. In other words, we have many cases who are extremely similar or identical, even in different moments and in different waves too. And this is extremely interesting because this shows that we are facing something real and not imaginary. You understand?
Yes, exactly. Something very real. And there weren't too many reports of close encounter, were there? Or there were some?
Well, our Centro Ufologico Nazionale, our center, in 57 years of existence, filed about 13,000 investigated cases during the last century. This means that really there are a lot of UFO events. Some of them were masked or quite unknown. You have to look in the old newspapers, and so you have to investigate them later. But in any case, this is extremely important because you understand that in spite of what the media publish, the events, the UFO events, occur really, in spite of us.
Yeah, exactly. And the other thing that happens is a lot of people, and it depends very much on the individual culture, a lot of people will be very hesitant to report a close encounter.
Absolutely.
That was true all over the world in those days. And therefore, you don't quite know what was happening. It's interesting that Brazil is a very different sort of culture. Brazilians are much more open to, you know, they're going to make a noise about it if something like this happens.
That's correct.
For them,
it's normal.
Yeah, exactly. For them, it's normal. And it's how normal. Can we even be saying that? It's remarkable that we would even be saying that, but it's quite true. For them, it's normal. What about more recent flaps in Italy? There have been some more recent ones, I believe.
Well, I have my opinion about that.
Please let us know.
Up to the first decade of 2000 years, we had different waves. But at present, it seems that waves do not manifest themselves like before. In other words, for instance, before we had UFOs with UFO occupants, absolutely. Now it seems that this aspect is a little disappearing, in the sense that probably we have been watched by remote piloted objects. For instance, what in South America is called flotillas, that is fleets of UFOs, in other words. This is occurring also in Italy and in Europe. It seems that probably these objects are not too big. Probably they are spheres about 1 meter in diameter or something like that, no more. Groups of many of them, and they fly all together, and it's possible that they are simply probes having the possibility to record what may be interesting for these guys up there.
Yeah, the question is, why are, you know, we have to say, why are they here? Because they're here for some reason, and it's always changing. There were big flaps in the 50s and 60s and 70s. Mm-hmm. Abductions developed in the 70s in the United States, yeah, and various other countries. And then in the 80s, they slowly trailed off. Then now it's becoming, there are people in the United States, in fact, I was just on Facebook last night with one of them, who was talking about, he was live streaming a UFO over San Antonio, Texas, actually my hometown. And that's not unusual. There's a man named John Martin in Georgia who routinely takes images of UFOs. And there's a more than one person in Sedona, Arizona, who actually takes tours out every night to photograph UFOs. And the ones in Sedona are very careful. They have Melinda Leslie knows every satellite in the sky. So she knows when she's got something anomalous. So what's all this about? Why is it changing like this, do you think, Roberto?
Well, it's hard to say, but I think that we may consider a detail. The detail is that there is surely a link between the observers and the objects, in the sense that, for instance, I'll tell you a very curious sighting 4 years ago. We had our World UFO Congress in San Marino, and in 2 days. And the second day, while we are having our Congress, people came into the theater in which we had the event and said, come out, UFOs are here. Mm? We considered that this was a joke, but it was not a joke. We went out, and in the broad daylight, we were hovered about 100 different dots of light crossing in the skies all together. And we filmed them. It was a lot of people who could film this with their phones. No problem. And the question is, why? Well, we were, there in order to have our Congress, this event occurred. It was a case. Well, I don't know, but maybe we should consider one thing. If you have a group of people, 300, 400, 500 people, all together thinking all together the same thing, UFOs, in other words. Well, it's like that you may project outside of you your thoughts. And if by chance someone could have the possibility to feel this, to receive this thought message, if we may call this in this way, well, maybe this could be sufficient in order to manifest themselves. No, why not? Frankly, I have no answer, but frankly, we asked ourselves why this happened.
Now, are you saying that the thoughts and interest of the people created the UFOs or drew them?
No, that this may call the UFOs, in the sense that the thoughts are some have their reality after all. But a group of thoughts by different people, right, 300, 400, 500 people all together, may be something which may be received by someone. But this is just
exactly. I agree. I'm sure that happens. Certainly happened when there used to be conferences in Gulf Breeze, Florida. Yeah. That would happen all the time, that they would show up. Speaking of showing up, folks, we're going to take another brief break. We'll be right back. And this is the last break, I'm happy to say, for you who are listening on the free side. We're talking to Roberto Pinotti. His website, robertopinotti.com. His book, UFO Contacts in Italy. I believe the volume one is available on Amazon. Volume two, I'm not so sure. Is it available, Roberto, volume two?
Well, really, I have back the rights of the book, and probably I must publish it again. But apart from this, what is interesting is that recently I published just in a week this book will be out in Italy, a new book about the so-called Mussolini UFO. You know, this was
we're getting to the USA
like this.
Right, we're getting ready to talk about that. We'll be talking about that in a few minutes, because it's of course the main reason we're here. But I wanted to background it very thoroughly, because it's one of the most important UFO cases of all now, because of what you did and what you found, Roberto. You're the one who brought this case forward, and you happened to bring it forward at just the same time that David Grush was appearing before Congress in the United States, approximately the same few months. And therefore, it received a lot of notice, but it deserves more notice. And I'm pretty sure, we'll get into it. Let's start to get into it now. Let's go back now to Italy in the early 30s. And what was Italy then? It was a very different place than it is now.
Yes, it was quite different. In the 30s, after 1922, we had the fascist regime. And like all the regimes, of course, the fascist regime did also good things. But at last, of course, we know what happened. Well, what is important to say is that in any case, the fascist state was a dictatorship, of course. And Benito Mussolini was the political leader in charge for this. Of course, nobody could expect that UFOs could be involved at a sort of extent in that period. But now we had to convince ourselves that it was not like this. Everything began when I received by post a letter containing different documents. These documents were contained, and we are speaking of original documents, not photocopies. These documents were contained in a sheet, which is like this, you see, in the hands of His Excellency Galeazzo Ciano. Who was Galeazzo Ciano? Galeazzo Ciano was Mussolini's son-in-law, and also the foreign affair minister of Italy. And in this envelope, we had a complete report of a UFO sightings occurred in 1936 over the town of Venice and Mestre. And in different pages, there was everything reported. What I may show you here is, for instance, a page of this report. And you see, we have also the drawing of the object like it was seen. An elongated, big object with portholes or something like that, emitting two smaller objects. They were saucer-shaped, as you see. This is a complete report made by Italian authorities. So we had the problem to verify if this could have been possible, and we discovered absolutely that it could be possible. Consider that these objects, they tried to intercept them with the planes, biplanes, of course, you imagine, and it was useless. But apart from that, the report says also that there were also other cases 2 years before. And all this story, to be brief, reports that the Italian government created a group, a study group, in order to study these reports, because Mussolini thought that these objects could be a new weapon of another European country, France, England, or Germany, of course. And so they created a group called Cabinet RS-33. RS stands for Ricerche Speciali, Special Researchers. And 33 has nothing to do with a year like we thought originally. No, it is only a code having to do with new inventions and technologies. And this is because this scientific team had the purpose to study the problem from the standpoint of reverse engineering, in other words. Well, then other reports mention that in 1933, one of these objects had a crash landing and in Italy, not far from Magenta, in near Milan, in northern Italy, that it was recovered and deeply studied, of course. This group, the Cabinet RS-33, was directed by Guglielmo Marconi, because Guglielmo Marconi was not only the inventor of radio and the Nobel Prize, but at that time he was the president of the Royal Academy of Science of Italy. So it was involved for this. And other people were part of this team, normally engineers, astronomers, and so on. Well, to tell you like things were, we had this material after we studied them and saw that really everything was possible. We had to make forensic analysis, and so the objects proved to be really old reports created.
Roberto, when you say forensic analysis, are you saying that you analyzed some materials?
Yeah,
from
no,
the
we did this, of course. We had we gave the documents to a forensic expert in the Tribunal of Como, and he did the analysis, of course. He examined the paper, and he has also to ruin some of the documents because he had to verify if the ink, for instance, was really old, like the paper, and so on. And the result that really all this was written in the 30s. No problem at all. What is interesting is that, this forensic analysis was obviously important. But now, apart from what this mysterious sender sent us, and we suspect that in spite of the fact that he did not reveal us his identity, and probably today we think that he is dead, because today he would have to be more than 90. So it's very hard. Probably he had to do with the family of Galeazzo Ciano. And Galeazzo Ciano, by the way, consider that he was Mussolini's, as I told you, son-in-law. He voted against Mussolini in 1943, and this caused the crisis of the fascist regime. The effect was that, they killed him. But apart from that, you understand, probably he had documents, and these documents are now available. But what is
interesting is that
we found other documents, and these documents were given us before his death by an Italian premier, Senator Giulio Andreotti. And these documents mention, all of them, this cabinet RS-33. Also, they say where this cabinet has its experiments. That was a mountain not far from Rome, Mount Sorate, which it was something like Cheyenne Mountain in the USA, because it was an excavated mountain, and inside it there were many researches made, you understand. So now we have something historical in our hands, and this is extremely important. Now, no more than 3 weeks ago, we had an incredible surprise. This year, we have the 150 years of the date of the birth of Guglielmo Marconi. Incredible, but Marconi's nephew was interviewed by General Press in Italy, and a journalist asked him, "Oh, by the way, but someone says that your grandfather had to do with a research team about UFOs. What do you think about that?" And he answered, "Obviously, it was like this. Yes, exactly. The cabinet RS-33. So he confirmed everything, you understand. Incredible. And this has nothing to do, of course, with our investigation. Then there is also what David Grush had recently told in the United States during a Congress meeting, you know, in which he said that he could say that the first recovered UFO was an object which had crash-landed in Italy in 1933, and that it was captured by American troops in 1945 and taken to the USA. And this is the story. So everything is fits to the whole story and is also confirmed by more and more details. And this is extremely important, because this means that the UFO problem was not born in the USA in the 40s, but more or less in Europe, in Italy, in the 30s, and that this also shows another important thing. The technology was the same. So it's stupid to think that this technology may have to do with another power today. It's incredible. UFOs cannot be Russian, cannot be Chinese.
We've come to the end of the free section of Dreamland, and we will be continuing on with our subscribers and getting into some of the details about the mechanics of this object that was found and what it sounded like, and some extremely interesting things, some ideas I've had about its possible significance. So those of you on the free side, as always, thank you so much for being with us on Dreamland. We're talking to Roberto Pinotti, his website, robertopinotti.com. Roberto is the premier UFO researcher in Italy, I think, without a doubt. And we've been talking about this object that was found, and it was kept then, it was examined initially. Let me go back. Do you know anything about any sound that it made before it came down to the ground?
Well, frankly, the documents we examined simply mention the fact, and mention also that the fascist regime did its best to prevent people to know about this. So there was a general cover-up about the case, and this may be easily understandable, of course.
Well, but why is it, though? Because the governments always react the same way. They immediately start covering this up.
Absolutely. But why? Absolutely. Absolutely. It's a question of national security and also of public order, after all. Yes. So the problem is that the object is not described. The only who had details and described it was David Grush, because he said exactly that this object was about 10 or 12 meters in diameter. Exactly. It is exactly what he said. And this is absolutely identical. It fits with the report of the 1936 sightings we saw before, in the sense that in the report they say that this object, the two objects, the smaller objects ejected from the torpedo-like object, were probably 12 meters in diameter. So it fits. But yes, what I asked to David Grush, because we had the possibility to speak about this, I asked, but excuse me, okay, the object was captured in 1945 after the defeat of the Nazis in northern Italy by American troops, and OSS took them to the United States. But how did this happen? Because it was a big object, 10 or 12 meters in diameter.
Yeah, that's 30 feet.
How did this happen? And we were in this, we had the same idea. The idea is that probably it was taken to the United States by sea, in other words, in a ship. And it's nothing particularly strange, this, because consider that, for instance, we have photographs of, you know, that during the last, the final part of the Second World War, both the Germans and the Italians had the jets, because they created jets, really. Jets,
and almost at the same
time. Yes, and they were caught, they were taken to the United States on the aircraft carriers. You understand? So it's possible that also this object may be had been taken to the United States in the same way.
I wonder if there was any propulsion system, because the image of the object suggests that it might have had a propulsion system, and if it did, could it have inspired the jet, do you think?
Well, as far as I can say, I think that no. Probably this this recovery caused the Italian and German technicians to face aviation from a different point of view. And so they tried to study different ways of flying, I see. And so probably the jet engines were the more possible effect of these studies. But as far as we know, UFOs are a different propulsion. They do with a sort of, how could we say, is a anti-gravity, probably, or something like that.
You know, interestingly enough, you bring that up, and by the time this show is run, I'm pretty sure that a NASA scientist will have announced that he has developed anti-gravity, publicly announced this.
Yeah.
That's about to happen as we speak, and we're recording this about 3 weeks before the show actually airs. So, folks, you probably already will know about this by the time it airs. The story will certainly appear on Unknown Country as soon as we can do it. So we're making progress in that regard. And interestingly enough, the little piece of material that is layered bismuth and magnesium has been a factor in this research that's led to the creation of this anti-gravity, which is conceivably going to revolutionize transportation in the world. And so it's an exciting moment. I have a piece of that material myself, but nobody wants mine. So fine, I'll keep mine myself until somebody asks for it. So Roberto, this object was taken to the United States. Probably, do you know where it went? Because I would guess the only place it would have gone in those days would have been to the Air Materiel Command at Wright Field.
It could be.
Yeah.
It could be. As far as I can tell you, Well, consider that the studies of Italian technicians and also of German technicians, because after the outbreak of Second World War, Italy and Germany and Nazi Germany were allied. No, you understand.
Right,
and
yes.
There is also a project of a German-Italian flying saucer, a round object with a cupola. It was conceived by two technicians, a German one, Mitte, and an Italian one, Belluzzo. Of course, this object was not built, but we have it on the sheet. they conceived it. So this means that they tried to copy, in other words, from the standpoint of reverse engineering, probably this object, in order to find something else, but they did not succeed in obtaining results. They had other results. For instance, Marconi died in 1937, but consider that, for instance, these studies probably had to do with what was called the Marconi death ray. You know the story.
I know the story, but my listeners may not.
Yeah.
Tell us about
it. Was not a legend.
Right.
No, it was not a legend. International press spoke about this extensively. No, really, Marconi found a way to use a sort of, it was not a ray, it was some projection of energy, and this energy could simply stop the engines of tanks, of cars, and even of airplanes. And he made, before he died, in the presence of Mussolini, a test of this. Italian press spoke about this. The problem is that he did not give the secret of this invention to Mussolini and to anybody, because Marconi was a Catholic and was very close to Pope Pius XI, which was, remember, anti-Nazi. And so the Pope said, "My son, please, don't give this invention to anybody, because if you do this, you'll transform who has this invention in the conqueror of the world. Don't do this." And this is exactly what Marconi did. But it's not too difficult to understand the key of this weapon, you understand?
Right. When you say the key of the weapon, I am fascinated. What is the key of the weapon?
Well, probably it has to do with the electromagnetic rays. Because besides, a very interesting thing is that one of the recent historical documents we found, it speaks about the fact that Cabinet RS-33 had to do with Mount Sorate and the tunnels in Mount Sorate where they worked. But in one of these documents, they also say that they had to make experiments with electromagnetism. And this is interesting because, as you know, this effect was often verified in UFO cases. UFOs had to do with electromagnetism, really. And propulsion probably has to do with
it. Well, yeah, they stopped cars. I had the father of one of my friends was driving in a town called Leveland, Texas, in the early 50s and was part of a big UFO event, and in the sense that he saw a UFO on the roadside and it stopped his car.
Exactly.
So it seems
a lot of cases in Italy speak about this.
So it maybe Marconi figured out why that was the case.
Yeah.
And built, he was a genius, of course, and unlike the people who apparently have been trying to figure out UFOs ever since, he got somewhere.
Yeah,
absolutely. This is just fascinating. So the object, was it ever taken to Germany during the war?
No. The German had nothing to do with this. This remains Marconi's secret. Because
the object that was found, the UFO, was that ever taken?
No. The object was sent by the Americans to the United States. Okay, but as far as we know, Marconi's invention had nothing to do with the object found in 1933. It's probably a sort of effect of the studies they made on the object.
Right. Yes, exactly. Now, there's a lot of talk, and it's never been very clear about whether or not the Germans developed something along the lines of a real UFO. And if they did, you'd think that it came from examination of this object. Of the object that the Italians had found.
Well, surely the Nazis were aware of this, because between 1940 and 1945, Italy and Germany were allied. Oh, it's not correct in the sense that, as you know, after the outbreak of Second World War, Italy entered the war in 1940. But in 1943, there was a completely changing of the situation, because with the Germans in Italy, Mussolini's regime fell, and so Italy was divided in two. Southern Italy remained free without the Germans. And from Rome towards to the north, the Germans were there. So Mussolini proclaimed the so-called Italian's Social Republic, which was a state which was an ally of Nazi Germany. And only about 1 year and something more later, in 1945, we had the defeat of the Nazis, and so Italy restored its unity, you understand. Of course, the Second World War had created big problems to our country, of course.
That's one of the more profound understatements we've ever heard on Dreamland. Yes, it did indeed. So what apparently happened here was this object was studied. Some things were learned from it. Some things were learned in other ways by Marconi. And then it ended up being sent to the United States, where I wonder if it still exists.
I think so. According to Grush, yes. It is stored in some place in the USA, of course.
Because I have an uncle who was at Wright Field when the Roswell materials brought there.
It's possible.
And he never mentioned this object. He was very circumspect, but he did, after I published Communion, he did talk to me. He spent some time with me. I went to his home, which was the Lackland Air Force Base Retirement Village, Lackland Retirement Village in San Antonio. And we had a long conversation over a lunch about what the United States had, and it became obvious that he had A, worked on this extensively, and B, there were physical objects that we had, and he, at one point, he asked me, "Have you seen the materials?" And I said, "Well, if I say yes, then what will you ask me? And he said, well, I will ask you for a description of them. And if your description is correct, we can talk further about them. I said, well, Uncle, I'm not going to lie to you. I haven't seen the materials. I just was wanting to know if that was a sort of code. And he said, well, yes, it is, because they are very specific. And there are intact discs in Florida, he said. At the time, I mean, this was many years ago, in 1988. So if they were at an air base in Florida then, maybe they've been moved. I don't know. But in any case, he had seen them. I think it's quite clear. And I just wonder if this object was not among them. And also, did you ever ask David Grush anything about, I don't think I've seen anything about this, its location, where it is now?
No. He, of course, you know that he had the possibility to tell us certain things, but not other things. Yeah. By the way, I may tell you something else very interesting. Many years ago, in 1971 and 72, during the Cold War, I was an officer, a lieutenant, in an elite brigade of the Italian army. It was a NATO unit with atomic warheads. And of course, my military duty was 15 months and nothing else. But in any case, just before leaving my military life, I was asked by my commander to prepare a lecture about UFOs to document the superior officers of our unit. I accepted and I did it. Okay. Well, I may tell you a very curious detail, but consider that we were in 1972. Don't forget this. Well, immediately before my lecture about UFOs, two American officers, we worked with them in NATO, of course. They were the proprietors of the atomic warheads, of course, came to our officer club and asked me, oh, Lieutenant, you are going to have a lecture about UFOs. Ah, yes. Ah, wonderful. What are you going to say? And I told them what I was going to say in this lecture, including the extraterrestrial hypothesis, of course. And then they looked at me and said, by the way, but do you know that we in the States have the crashing crafts and the bodies of the pilots? And I did not know what to tell. I remained in silence because at that time, in 1972, nobody mentioned this. The first book about Roswell was in 1978 or 79. So you understand that.
Yes, that's right.
And of course, this was made, this happened because you understand, we were allied, no? We were bought in uniform. So it's a sort of coincidence, of confidence and nothing else. But this is important.
Well, I would like to go back to the German issue, because as you've put in the article, the extensive article you wrote about this, which we will have a link to on the Unknown Country website, there was something that was created called the German V7, the disc-shaped aircraft, which was initially developed after Italian research. Can you tell us what you know, or what reasonable speculations you can make about this craft?
Yes, I know this. The Professor Hermann Oberth, who was, after all, the teacher of Werner von Braun, said that really V7 was called like in this way, was a round object, and it was created in only one example, only one. And they had a test flight with this object, with this craft, and it seems that it was not so particularly good from the standpoint of its creation. In any case, they destroyed it to prevent that, the fact that it could be captured by the Russians, because it was in Austria, as far as I know. So we know that V7 was a round object, really. At a certain extent, it may be compared with flying saucers or UFOs, call them like you want. But yes, really, this existed. Consider that the Germans had from V1 to V7 a group of Wunderwaffen, no? Their secret weapons. V1 and V2 were flying bombs. Then V4 was called the America Rakete, the rockets to America, and was more or less an intercontinental ballistic missile. And thank heaven it was not used, because they wanted to bomb New York.
Right, of course they did. They would love to bomb V7, New York.
And V7 really had this form, and it seems that they tested it only once in Austria, but then it seems that this object was destroyed to prevent they could be captured by the Russians.
Then it was intended to go into outer space, as I understand it.
Who knows?
You say in your article that this flying disc to be sent into space, subsequently renamed the flying wheel.
As far as we know, well, I know that there is someone who writes such things, but the fact that that we have no proofs of this. By the way, another incredible Wunderwaffe was, for instance, what they called the bell. Nobody knows what the bell was, but the Nazis had created really this strange bell-like object, and nobody knows if it was a flying craft or a craft having the possibility to create an enormous energy, having to do also the possibility to distort the time-space continuum, imagine. But of course, there are only voices, you understand? And we have not really proofs of this. By the way, consider one thing. The Nazis were defeated. But after their defeats, there are neo-Nazis who like to create such stories in order to show that the Nazis were very, very clever people and so on. So, okay, but up to a certain extent. Let's see, because what is important are proofs, of course. Now we have documents, we have everything which fits with all this scheme. Okay, so surely UFOs existed in the 30s. UFOs were studied by the Italians and also by the Germans up to the end of the Second World War. Probably these studies also created new developments in science. But this is one thing, to think that they really had the possibility to fly to space. I dubbed it.
Well, of course, if they did have the possibility to fly to space, that might be one reason that we can't find them. In any case, you know, we had folks some years ago, Joseph Farrell did a show about the bell, and I'll have a link to that show on the website. So when you watch this on YouTube or listen to it, you want to go to find out Joseph Farrell's ideas about the bell, there will be a link available to subscribers to listen to that show. It's an old show, so it will not want me a video. It'll be an audio show. Roberto Pinotti, I would like to thank you so much for being with us on Dreamland. Roberto's website is robertopinotti.com. He is doing extraordinary work and has led one of the great lives in, is leading, I hope for a long time to come, one of the great lives in UFO research in the world. And I'm so proud to know you. Roberto is...
It was my pleasure.
Well, thank you.
But we met, remember that we met many years ago.
Yeah, that's right. We did.
We did, but we had no time to discuss because, unfortunately, in Congress, this is a drama. You have no time to discuss.
Right, exactly. When is the next conference planned in San Marino?
Yes, and the 1st and the 2nd of June, next June.
Of June of 2025?
Yes.
Well, I hope you invite me because I really would like...
No. 24, this year. This year.
That's right. And that's the reason I can't come is because I'm going to, and this will be, this actually will be presented after the conference is over.
Okay.
Is there one plan for 2025 yet?
Well, probably we'll do the same, more or less, I think in the spring, but we have not decided the date yet.
Well, if you do it, don't forget me. I want
absolutely.
Wonderful.
We are friends.
All right. Well, Roberto,
it was a pleasure, Whitley.
Indeed.
Keep on your good work.
Thank you, and your work is wonderful, and you've done so much and accomplished so much. So thank you very much, and
thank you
for being with us on Dreamland.
Send me a copy of this, of our encounter.
I will, Roberto.
Yeah. Thank you so much.
You've been listening to Dreamland. Be sure to tune in again next week. Dreamland is brought to you by UnknownCountry.com and its family of subscribers. Our theme music is The O of Pleasure by Ray Lynch. Unknown Country was founded by Ann Streber. Our news editor is Matthew Frizzell. Our coordinator is Amy Safrankova. Whitley Streber is your Dreamland host. And I'm your announcer, Ted Alexander.